Matthew Alim. For the appellant, Ms. Powell.
Thank you. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court, Mr. Hendershot, Mr. French. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. I want to first take a moment to clarify Matthew's first due process claim. So children in Ohio have a protected procedural liberty interest in the treatment of juvenile court. And that's because original exclusive subject matter jurisdiction over offenses committed by children under 18 exists in the juvenile court. And so this liberty interest arose when Ohio decided to have a juvenile court system. And more importantly for our purposes here, this liberty interest arose when Ohio, previous to 1996, afforded every child transferred to adult court an amenability hearing. After 1996, the legislature made transfer for certain offenses automatic. So it's because there was this previously given liberty interest that the case is here today. So the enactment of the mandatory transfer system, the legislature stripped away all these protections that had previously existed in juvenile court through this amenability determination. And in that, it stripped away all the unique features that juvenile courts generally provide. So because children have a liberty interest in juvenile court proceedings generally, and because they previously had an interest in amenability hearings, the question here is whether that new system, this mandatory transfer system, infringes on a child's protected liberty interest in a way that offends due process. And so if I could say, the test for this is to look at the nature of the interest, and it's a procedural liberty interest, and then to look at the extent to which the due process afforded must be influenced, the extent to which the due process must be afforded is influenced by the extent to which a juvenile may be condemned to suffer a grievous loss. And here the grievous loss is not just in this juvenile court treatment, but it's in the privacy that juvenile court proceedings afford, in the stigmatization that occurs when a child is transferred to adult court. The grievous loss is a lifetime of collateral consequences that come with an adult conviction, and the loss of opportunity in the juvenile-specific treatment that juvenile affords. So in the weighing test under Matthews, the question is whether the child's interest in treatment as a child in juvenile court and in an amenability hearing, which would occur at a meaningful time and in a meaningful opportunity in this matter, whether that outweighs the government's interest in this summary adjudication. So here the child's interest does outweigh the state's interest, and that's because the risk of erroneous deprivation with a system that affords very little due process is very high. The extent to which a child can suffer a grievous loss is also very high. And the state's interest in a system that is based on myth and is at best a failed experiment has to be very, very low.
What's the subset of folks of juveniles for which there's an automatic bindover?
So a couple of subsets. The subset at issue here are children like Matthew who are 16 or 17 and commit certain Category 2 offenses with a gun. Not at issue in this case are Category 1 offenses and the more certain serious offenses. And again, under old law, those kids all got amenability hearings. It was the same.
All right. What you would have us write, would that apply to all juveniles, regardless of the nature of the offense?
I think so. This case concerns just that one subset.
I
think it does necessarily follow, and in part because the argument is based on the practical morass that we found ourselves in.
If the juvenile was 17 and committed multiple murders, there would still need to be a due process hearing in juvenile court.
Sure.
No automatic bindover.
Right, and the reason for that is it does seem like a summary adjudication would be appropriate there, because we would presume that that child is a bad kid and is in that very narrow subset of the rarest of children whose crimes reflect irreparable depravity. But the liberty interest is in the process. And so where the system creates no process, that summary adjudication just doesn't make sense.
But the legislature can determine where cases are tried, can it not?
Sure.
It could eliminate juvenile court.
It could.
and it's made a policy determination that there's no constitutional right to a juvenile trial, and this category of cases, all equally treated, mm-hmm. are tried as adults. Why can't the policy of the state be that way?
Well, I think the argument would be different if we had a direct file. And some
if we had a what?
If we had cases directly filed in adult court, and we don't have that, that would be a different argument, a different case. These cases originate in juvenile court. And before this mandatory transfer law was enacted, all children got this due process. When the mandatory transfer and this automatic transfer happened, there were due process rights that were stripped away. And the question is, did they need to be replaced with anything? It sure
Counselor,
seems like they
did. You're saying the state wasn't justified. It didn't have a good enough reason to strip these away. Just by virtue of age, 16 or 17, coupled with a certain crime, whereas if that same crime, that same action, let's call it that way because they don't call them crimes, I guess, in the juvenile arena, but that same activity that would have been committed by a 14 or 15-year-old would subject that individual to an amenability.
Correct.
Okay. And so then just by virtue of age and the state's theory being that whatever the testimony was to the legislature, that was enough to convince them that there are certain 16 and 17-year-olds who commit certain activities that are would be crimes or felonies in the adult world, automatically are not amenable, absolutely not amenable.
Correct.
And so they jump over to the adult court.
Right, and that's a one-size-fits-all system for those 16 and 17-year-olds. And I think any of us who know kids, and I always like to think of the Little League World Series, where you have this really tall first baseman who is maybe 15, and you have this teeny little shortstop, you know, who gets up and drills one and runs really fast to first base. And so you have this really tall teenager and this really tiny teenager who develop at very different rates, standing on the same base side by side. And so I think what we know is that there's nothing magical that happens at 16. I think we also know that nothing magical happens at 18 either. Let's be real about that. But the Supreme Court of the United States has drawn the line at 18. And despite repeated invitations to draw that line further, they haven't done so. So then the question with the guys on the first base, just by virtue of their age, if one is slightly older than another, is that person entitled to less due process rights, fewer due process rights, just by virtue of his age? Is he somehow more able to understand the process that he doesn't need those special protections?
Isn't that the theory? I mean, there must have been enough testimony from juvenile experts before the legislature that said there's some real scientific basis, some real psychological basis, some real, real world experience basis here. I'm presuming that's what was presented.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor, because at that time the testimony was, if a child commits an offense like this, he's so dangerous that he's irredeemable, and that we're going to hold older children to a higher standard of culpability. So the time when that testimony was presented to the legislature was a different world. And we understood the world in a much different way than we do now. Since 2005 in Roper, we know that the world operates in some ways the same way we've always believed, but now in a constitutional sense, we're required to look at these children differently. After JDB, we know that children deserve greater protections in juvenile court. Now, the state is gonna come up here and say that this is just a mere forum change. And I think Justice O'Donnell's question was in this kind of area. It's not just merely a forum change. It's a stripping of due process rights in a system that now doesn't exist in juvenile court.
Any juvenile who's bound over is afforded due process in a criminal proceeding as an adult.
Correct. And in some ways—
How are you saying you're stripping away due process? That person is still subject to all the rights of due process,
so
just in a different forum.
Correct, but in the juvenile form is unique. And so the due process protections in some ways are fewer. You don't have a right to jury, you don't have the right to bail, but the breadth and the depth of the protections that exist in juvenile court are far greater. And so when a child zooms on to adult court, sure, he gets the right to a jury trial and the right to bail, But all of those other special protections, that subjective understanding, the totality of the circumstances, all the consideration of the unique factors of youth no longer exists. And more importantly,
why do you say they no longer exist? Why can't a sentencing court take all of that into consideration?
They can.
They do.
But their options are not the same as the consequence of this activity. The consequences in a juvenile court is much different than the consequences to a 16 or 17-year-old in the adult court, because they're facing adult prison.
Correct.
And that is the ultimate here as to why I think we've got this problem before us.
Right. And as this court recognized in CP, the child's life is over before it's even begun at that point. And so a few extra due process protections and maybe a discount at sentencing comes not only too little too late, but it doesn't suffice to give the child the opportunity that is a liberty interest in that juvenile court process.
Counsel, the idea of mandatory transfer is what we're talking about here, correct?
Correct.
You're not arguing that the discretionary transfer is also a violation?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, looking at the substitute means, and this court can do that in the weighing test, or the additional means that could be considered in this balance, and also looking at Kent, to be honest, like those are, that's the process that does meet the constitutional requirement. So I'm not saying that at all.
So you're saying that position would follow the recent Supreme Court cases that talk about giving specialized specialized consideration of the individual at that stage.
Right.
That's the important thing.
Right, and it as this court recently mentioned in DS, it reinvigorates the juvenile court judge's unique role. And so this court has repeatedly emphasized that unique role and that unique expertise. And so when the legislature passed this law, it took that judge's unique role and it took that unique experience and that judge's perspective of that child and that child's siblings and that child's family in the context of the crime, and requires the judge to sit on his or her hands and be blinded to all those things that juvenile court judges.
But isn't there a rational relationship and to public safety? Doesn't the legislature make that kind of an analysis?
Right, and that's why the passage of time here helps us, because we know that this perception of safety and the super predator myth that existed in the 90s that got us in this place is no longer true. There's a pile of case law.
There must be at least 5 or 6 state Supreme Courts that have said that this is not a violation of due process. I'm sure you're familiar with that line of cases.
Right, right. And I'm sure that this court is well familiar that recent developments and the way Ohio uniquely values a juvenile court judge and the juvenile court process puts us in a different position than those states.
How about a rational relationship based on a deterrence? Is there any argument here that a 16 or 17 year old is deterred because it's going to be an automatic trip to adult court?
Well, so that I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor. And it's important because we know that kids perceive risk differently. They also perceive consequences differently. And so look at a person like Matthew Aleem or Alex Quarterman, who was here a while ago. Those kids are going to get out of prison in 4 short years. He's going to get out at age 20. Matthew will get out of prison at age 20. In the juvenile court system, he could be subject to sanctions until he's 21. You give a teenager that choice, and remember at the sentencing hearing, Matthew's attorney was fighting hard for community control. And so a child, given all their unique qualities, can't evaluate those decisions in the same way an adult can, can't look at the 500 collateral sanctions that attach, can't perceive the 5 years of post-release control, maybe don't understand that there's a presumption of incarceration. They think, I've got this, I've got a good attorney. And they make dumb choices. So kids can't make those decisions either.
So you're saying it's not a deterrent?
Oh, right. So as to deterrent, sure. And sorry, I forgot where the question was. The deterrent effect has been addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court and by this court. The deterrent effect for teenagers, for these people, is nil, because they see the moment. And that's the kind of things that make them make
counsel,
that decision.
I may ask you, are we talking about the statute today, or are we talking about your client? And the reason I ask that, is there anything in the record that indicates this particular child just needs to go upstairs?
So it's about the statutes, but they're interrelated, because there isn't anything in this particular record that shows that this kid needs to get to go upstairs. And so I think it is important to remember that a universally applied one-size-fits-all system for 16 and 17-year-olds gets it wrong in some circumstances. Matthew had never been court-involved before. This was his first offense. It's a bad offense, but the juvenile court judge couldn't consider that.
So you're saying if the juvenile court judge had discretion to keep this case, he could not?
He could not. He absolutely could not. And that's the process that's not afforded that makes the statute unconstitutional.
And we're not just talking 16-year-olds, are we? I think your brief suggests that there are certain offenses that even at age 14 may be mandatory transfer.
No, Your Honor, it's only 16 and 17.
All right. So age 14 regarding transfer?
Discretionary. Yes.
Ms. Powell, is there any opportunity for the common pleas judge to return the child to the juvenile court?
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's what we now call the rabbit hole of absurd results. So sure, there's an opportunity if the child is convicted of a crime that would not be a mandatory bind over offense, then under 121, that child would ping pong back to the juvenile court for an amenability determination. And so I think that's important. The legislature pieced together a fix because they recognize some kids get over and then don't deserve to be there. And that legislative fix has been a practical nightmare that this court struggled with in a recent argument in Brookshire. And this remedy that Matthew seeks, and the remedy is one that existed pre-96 before this bad law, this failed experiment, wipes out 121. Every kid gets an amenability hearing, so that ping-ponging would literally not exist.
That statement, by the way, was in paragraph 7 of the Court of Appeals opinion. So there was some confusion there.
Right. And so the common pleas judge did grapple with, well, if I send this back, what does that even mean? Does the kid just go away? Like, there wasn't, the common pleas judge needed direction. And if the judge knew that the judge could send it back for an amenability determination, which is what we're asking for today, that would be an easy get. Let the expert decide if this child needs juvenile court treatment or not. In Montgomery versus Louisiana recently, the United States Supreme Court looked at this class of under 18s. And I think of it like a pie chart. It divided those children up into those whose crimes reflect transient immaturity of youth. And in the pie chart, that's a huge, you know, giant piece. And the rarest of children whose crimes reflect irreparable depravity. So that matters here because we know kids are less culpable. We know that not every 16 and 17-year-old who commits an offense with a gun is dangerous. We know that, and we know that some of them are redeemable. So that matters here because we also know that under this law, Ohio's juvenile judges have this rare juvenile proceeding. So this is a proceeding in juvenile court that's unlike any other proceeding in juvenile court, where in this instance only, the juvenile court judge has to sit on his or her hands and can't do any of the things that they're used to doing.
And it's only based on age and crime and the combination. A 17-year-old that does, you know, something we would think is reprehensible, but if it's not one of the enumerated crimes, they're going to get juvenile treatment.
Right.
And they could be bound over, but
right.
I guess it would be a different process through amenability.
Right.
But this automatic flip of the switch based on these two criterion is what the problem is.
It leads to the same result in every case. It doesn't lead to the best result in every case. And it strips the juvenile judges, who are uniquely qualified to do these things, of their ability to make such a determination. So if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
You've got
very
a few
much.
Seconds left.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Mr. French.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, good morning. There's been an interesting public policy argument made for why mandatory transfer statutes perhaps are unwise. for why the Ohio General Assembly should perhaps reexamine the rationale behind the statutes for who gets bound over and when and under what circumstances. But there really is no compelling legal argument for why this court should go against the holding and rationale of every other court that has decided these very issues.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, kind of a big picture question.
Yes, sir.
The Ohio General Assembly has just decided, and the United States Supreme Court has decided, everyone short of their 18th birthday is a juvenile, and they shall get special protection as they go to the kids' court, correct? Well, take that as my premise.
Okay.
The Ohio General Assembly has now said, if you're over 16 and you commit a certain crime, you don't get those protections. See you later. How is that equal protection under the law?
First off, Ohio has set the limit for certain offenses under certain circumstances at certain age at 16. They've set another line at 14 under certain circumstances. The U.S. Supreme Court has never held, that I'm aware of, that a juvenile has a right to juvenile court proceedings.
No, I understand that, but once we decide that we're going to give it to all children, do we have a right on an equal process basis to say all children except for you, and then you have an overlay, as in this case, this is a first offender, correct?
This is a first offender, yes.
So he's saying, don't send me up to the adult court. This is an indiscretion. I'm a kid. I want juvenile court protection like all kids. What's the rational basis to say, well, you don't get it?
Well, the juvenile court system is purely a creature of statute. It didn't exist at common law. It didn't exist anywhere in Ohio until the early 20th century. The legislature has created the system that they feel is appropriate. The legislature is entitled to set the parameters of who should be treated in juvenile court and under what circumstances. And those parameters have changed in every state.
But, counsel, wouldn't you agree that every child in juvenile court has a due process interest?
Yes.
Okay. So if the legislature created this entity called juvenile court, then all of the rights that come with, these are the same rights a child would have in adult court, but they transferred them to juvenile court because that's the carve out by the legislature, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if human beings under the age of 18 in Ohio are presumed to be in juvenile court with all of the rights attendant to their status as juveniles, except for 15 and 16-year-olds who do, commit this act, they don't get those rights. They don't get the rights of due process within the arena of juvenile court. They get different rights. And rights that are going to be orchestrated in adult court. And the consequences is what I'm concerned about, that are so very different in the juvenile court and the adult court, is what I find to be troubling about this protection of the consequences in juvenile court are not available to this a child of the same age in adult court.
Well, the Ohio General Assembly has made a determination that older juveniles who commit certain offenses under certain circumstances, particularly when these offenses are committed with a firearm, as Matthew Alem's case was, that it is necessary to bind them over in order to adequately protect the public from future offenses.
Even if they're amenable to the juvenile system?
Yes.
Okay, that's a problem I have, because that test is never, it's never applied, it's never tested, their amenability. It's we don't care if you could be rehabilitated and made better by the treatment, counseling, and consequences of juvenile court. We're going to send you to adult prison.
Well, there has never been recognized a constitutional right to an amenability hearing. There's never been a recognized constitutional right for treatment or disposition in juvenile court. Many states have different lines. There are some states who set the line at 13 for offenses similar to this. 13-year-olds can be tried in adult court.
But counsel, again, I don't think you're answering the chief's question. The concern that we have is that in this case, this juvenile court judge was not even given the opportunity to say, I got this, I can handle this. It's a first-time offender, had a real bad day, we can fix this kid. And the Ohio General Assembly is saying, no, we're not going to permit that.
And that is within their parameters to do.
So they can carve out a portion of the population saying you don't get the same rights as every other kid.
Well, it's not a question of they don't get the same rights. They get the same due process rights.
Do they?
Yes, they do. In fact, juveniles who are bound over to adult court get greater due process protections than juveniles whose cases stay in juvenile court. If you're bound over to adult court, you have the right to grand jury consideration, the right to trial by jury, the right to pretrial bail, greater speedy trial rights. So from a process standpoint, due process is being afforded to all juveniles, and in fact, greater due process rights are being afforded to older juveniles. But the crux of the issue is punishment. That's what this is all about. It's not really about process. It's not about procedure. It's about what do we do to punish these juveniles who are transferred over to adult court.
I thought we're talking process, though. I mean, before 1996, you had the amenability process available to individuals who were age 16, correct? The judge still was able to look and say, this individual will be bound over to adult court. This one will stay in juvenile court, correct? Before 1996 and before mandatory bind over.
There were still a certain class of juveniles, perhaps juveniles 14 and older, who committed Category 1 offenses, homicide offenses, who were still at times subject to mandatory transfers as they are now. There has now been carved out another class of juveniles, those who commit Category 2 offenses with firearms, who, if you're 16 or 17 and commit a Category 2 offense with a firearm, you're subject to mandatory bindover. If you're 14 or 15 and commit a Category 2 offense and have had prior adjudications, you can, under certain circumstances, be subject to mandatory bindover. So it's not just a matter of age. It's a matter of your age, the offense you commit, the circumstances under which you commit it, and your prior history in the juvenile justice system that determine the parameters of who is subject to mandatory bindover and who is entitled to discretionary bindover.
So are you saying it's more than just age and offense?
Well, it's age and offense, circumstances of the offense. For instance, if you commit a Category 2 offense, if you're 17 and you commit a Category 2 offense.
For example, Category 2 would be?
Manslaughters, rapes, aggravated burglaries, aggravated robberies, serious violent felonies, typically first-degree felonies.
And that's what Matthew was charged with?
Yes. He was 16 and committed a Category 2 offense, but he committed the Category 2 offense with a firearm. That is the class that the legislature has determined should be subject to mandatory bindover.
But not every Category 2 will be mandated for a bindover, correct?
Correct.
You have to have a gun, and that's why he's in this class.
you have to either have a gun or have had a prior adjudication in which you were sent to DYS. So
don't states have the right to determine the parameters for trying juveniles as adults?
They do. And Ohio has set the parameters for Category 2 offenses with firearms at age 16. Some states have set it at 15. I believe Georgia sets it at 13. So
age in Ohio is an aggravating circumstance.
No, it is not. When you talk aggravating circumstances and mitigating factors, you're getting back.
It's a presumed aggravating circumstance. You're not going to examine it. If you've got a birth certificate that tells you what your age is and you've got the prosecutor that's telling what your charge is, it's you're automatically going to be bound over.
The forum under which your case will be heard has been changed. When you talk aggravating circumstance, now we're back into the category of punishment.
You are changing the playing field with the category of punishment that's available. You absolutely are, simply based on age. You would agree that the consequences in juvenile court are significantly different than the incarceration that is available in adult court.
Yes, they could be different, but not necessarily. And I guess it comes to a matter of opinion as
if you get bound over and the gun's involved, you're looking at 3-year mandatory just for the gun alone, right?
Yes, correct.
And that would not be the case in juvenile court.
In juvenile court, it would be mandatory 1 year. It would still be mandatory commitment to DYS. It would not be 3 years. Now, in this particular case, as we know, Matthew Alum entered a plea to aggravated robbery, and the firearm specifications were dismissed. Consequently, his sentence, no portion of his sentence was mandatory. It was purely discretionary. In fact, and he received a 4-year sentence. Now, had his case remained in juvenile court, and assuming that the firearm specification remained, at least 1 year of his sentence would be mandatory. Now, some would argue that's a harsher penalty than he ultimately got in adult court. In adult court, he received a 4-year sentence.
He received 4 years in an adult prison, as opposed to what you've described as mandatory 1 year in a youth residential detention center, correct?
1 year mandatory up to a possibility of 5, yes.
Okay, but let's look at where they're going to be placed.
Yes.
It's a detention center, a youth detention center, as opposed to an adult prison.
Yes.
Mr.
So then
French,
the question, I've never been in either.
You've never been inside either?
I've never been inside of a prison. I've never been inside of DYS or a
juvenile detention. They're different.
Yeah. Yes, they are different.
But Mr. French, I think what your friend Ms. Powell was saying is that's not what it's completely about, is the length of time. There are also lots of consequences that go along with an adult conviction that would not follow Matthew the way that the adult conviction would. So in that sense, can we really say that the punishment is less than he would have gotten in the juvenile system?
I would agree. You would not necessarily say that the punishment is less. Is it unconstitutional to punish older juveniles who commit violent felonies with guns harsher because they are in the adult system? Is that unconstitutional? I would say no.
Well, and is that really the question? I guess for me, is the question appears to be one of, if we're talking about due process,
yes,
are we considering the punishment, or are we really talking about how the child gets to the common pleas court?
We are talking specifically about how the case gets to common pleas court, and there's nothing that would violate fundamental fairness or due process in the manner in which the case proceeds. All the essential due process protections have been afforded juveniles, whether they remain in juvenile court or they are transferred to adult court.
Do you see any value to the discretionary decisions made by a juvenile judge in deciding whether to bind a juvenile over?
Yes, there could be value in allowing that discretion to be exercised, but that is within the parameters of the legislature to set those standards. You know, Ms. Powell mentioned the recent developments in U.S. Supreme Court cases. There's Graham, Miller, Roper, this court in NRACP. Those cases, again, dealt with punishment. Those were Eighth Amendment cruel and unusual punishment cases. And what those cases essentially held is you must treat juveniles differently from adults for sentencing purposes. And in all of those cases, the question was, are maximum mandatory sentences for adults cruel and unusual? And the court said yes. But keep in mind, in Miller, Roper, Graham, in every one of those cases, the juvenile was transferred to adult court, was prosecuted in adult court, was sent to an adult prison. And in none of those cases did the U.S. Supreme Court even hint that would be unconstitutional or a due process violation. The only thing they held is you cannot impose mandatory maximum extreme sentences on juveniles. You can send them to prison. You could send them to adult prison for a very long time. You just cannot impose mandatory maximum sentences. So I don't believe that the recent development of cases by the U.S. Supreme Court really have any address any of the issues raised in this case, which is the process by which cases are handled for older, violent juveniles with a gun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If Mr. Hendershot, I'm not sure how much time you have left, Mr. Hendershot. Go ahead.
I'll watch the light. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I want to start where my friend on this side started with it. Defining the liberty interest which undergirds the due process. Remember, the text of the 14th Amendment tells us there must be a life, liberty, or property interest to which the process attaches. And she says it was the pre-96 statute that is the basis of the liberty interest here. Well, that is an odd one-way ratchet. And think about the disincentive that creates for democratic experimentation in juvenile courts. What she is saying is, because before 1996 there was this discretionary transfer, and that was purely statutory, and the statute changed, the legislature can't do that. She's saying the Constitution bars democratic change
now,
in a one-way
ratchet. Counsel, possibly you're mischaracterizing the argument, though. I'm thinking that the argument is being made on a due process basis. I'm a kid. I need a hearing before you throw me away.
Your Honor, that is a choice for the democratic process. That is not part of the judicial power under Article 4. That's why every court is not covered by due process. No, setting the line at, if you look across the country, there's still 10 states that set the age of juvenile court under 18. So that is a choice that is made in the laboratories of democracy across the country. That is a choice for the people behind us, not the people up here. It is a question about for certain juveniles who commit serious crime,
you keep going to the democratic process. I assume that's with a small d, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
You're talking about that belongs to the legislature, not this court.
Correct.
But this court has the responsibility for protecting due process rights of all citizens, and due process in its simplest form is the right to be heard in a meaningful forum, which was denied in this case.
Your Honor, it was not denied. Think of it this way. Look at a very succinct paragraph in Connecticut Department of Public Safety versus Doe. This is a U.S. Supreme Court case, one of the best paragraphs ever written about procedural due process. And it says, no matter what fact you may prove as a 15-year-old that wants a driver's license, it is irrelevant. You could be the most mature, best driver in the world. The process you are due is the legislative process. It is determined this is the cutoff point for
driver's license. Is not a right. Due process and a hearing attendant to a loss of liberty is a totally different ball game.
Your Honor, whether it's driving, whether it's voting, whether it's this, you're right. There must be a
substantive... There is no right to drive. It's a privilege. So let's move on to another...
Sure. Say vote. Say the age at voting. You could try to prove that you are the most responsible citizen of all time at age 16. You're not going to be able to vote. The process that is due that is afforded in
the... That's uniform for all 18-year-old or all people under the age of the voting age. Here's a different process. If you are a 16 or 17-year-old and you have acted in such a way, you're not going to have the same benefit as a 15-year-old who has acted in the exact same way. So the only distinction is age, and age becomes an aggravating factor for the charge.
We could flip that around and say age is a mitigating factor for all 16 and 17-year-olds who have not committed serious crime. Ohio could have easily set the age, like New York still does, and say all 16 and 17-year-olds go to common pleas court. So it's only a mitigator if you look at it one way. You can flip it around and say, for most 16 and 17-year-olds in Ohio, age remains a mitigator. And it
well, the whole concept
so
of juvenile court recognizes the mitigation of youth.
It
we wouldn't have juvenile
it.
Courts if we didn't have that enlightened view that under 18 are children with all the attendant developmental levels. And that's why we have juvenile courts.
Sure, Your Honor, but whether we have juvenile courts at all and where we set that age is a legislative choice. Some states set it otherwise. Ohio has set it at 18 for many crimes, but lower for certain very serious crimes. So fairness to the victims, fairness across defendant to defendant, the General Assembly, the people of Ohio have said that means setting the age at 16 when you've committed a serious crime.
Is there a constitutional right to a juvenile court hearing?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. If you look at pages 13 and 15 of our brief, we've collected most of the cases. I won't represent that they're all of them that have said and looked at this question. None of them have said there is a substantive constitutional right at any age to be in juvenile court. And that's because there's greater process in adult court than there is in juvenile court.
Is this a separation of powers issue? Is that what you're arguing to us? Or are you saying that it's the policy set by the General Assembly and it can set whatever policy it wants?
It can set whatever policy it wants. So, Miller versus Alabama in those cases are the extreme end of punishment. That's where the Constitution comes to bear, at the extreme end of sentencing. The Constitution does not have something to say other than, as you
well,
suggest,
that's the court that is setting the line there where is extreme. I mean, you would have to say that. The court said you can't incarcerate children for life. That's extreme. The legislature
correct.
Said you can do that, okay? And then the court steps in and says, no, you can't do that. So the court is the arbiter of what is extreme, what is excessive, what is, even though, as you said, the legislature sets the rules, but the court can say your rules are too extreme, and we can do that here. Would you say that we cannot?
You cannot in this case, because I think it would be a fairly radical step from saying at the extreme end of punishment, age is relevant, to saying that age mandates a process. You'd have to be saying as a matter of federal constitutional law, the laws of 29 states are unconstitutional as we stand here
today.
Well,
we could use the Ohio Constitution, could we not?
Alum is not asking you to do that. On page 20 of his brief, he says, consider these clauses together. As far as I'm aware, in 70 years under both the equal protection guarantees and the due process, you have never decoupled those. So I think there's not an opportunity here to say
well,
the
Ohio
Constitution.
Well, this is a different problem that we're being presented with.
But it's the same text, Your Honor, and there's nothing about the text written in 1803 or 1851 that suggests those guarantees are more expansive than the ones written in 1868 in the 14th Amendment.
Thank you.
But we can be more protective under the Ohio Constitution than the federal Constitution.
May I answer, Your Honor?
Sure.
Sure. If there were a reason to decouple one, there isn't here. The text of both those guarantees does not suggest they're more expansive than the 14th Amendment.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Could?
So I was saying, as to Justice Lansgren's question about treating the Ohio due process and equal protection provisions more expansively, I would say that the text of the Ohio provisions does not suggest they're more expansive. ALEM has not asked that you treat them more expansively, and you have never treated them more expansively.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time. You may take a minute.
I'd like to talk about Goss v. Lopez and Goldberg v. Kelly. The United States Supreme Court has recognized that when a state gives a right, in Goss it was an educational right, in Goldberg v. Kelly it was a right to welfare. No question, those are not required by the Constitution. But once the state gives that right, it can't take away that right without sufficient due process. To use Mr. Hendershot's example, if we allowed children to vote at age 17 in Ohio and then unanimously decided that the age was 18, the question would be if the state could take away that previously inured right without due process. I want to also quickly say that the law pre-1996 did require amenability in every case. This is 2151-26, except, and there is an exception, and I want to say this, except kids who are charged with aggravated murder or murder who were previously adjudicated delinquent for committing aggravated murder or murder. And so that's a very different world. Every other offense was considered in juvenile court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement and you will be notified of our decision.